Start recording. Yep, we're good. All right, we're back with the Chungi Podcast. We're psyched to be here. We're talking about Okja and the Host today, which is the work of, I'm learning his name. Can you say his name?
Bong Joon-ho.
Yes, Bong Joon-ho. Who I hadn't watched any of his movies until Okja and the Host, and I was really impressed. Like, especially from a visual standpoint, he just like blows the socks off of anything I've seen in years. So, and then just like original stories, like making a movie that's just like a good movie because it's like it's original and well thought out. Like, that's definitely part of it.
He is one of my favorite directors of all time, probably my favorite working director today. And I just really love how just how thoughtful he is in terms of composing different scenes and camera blocking, and just how inventive he is with his stories. He's really, really wonderful.
The thing that really drew me in is, like, even if you're not that interested in the story, like, if you can't relate to the story or you think it's weird or whatever, like, if you, like, are attracted to the visual aspect at all, like, you have to be just, like, tuned into his films. Like, it's, like, it's just so beautiful visually and so clever and original that it's, like, I can't see how you would not. Like, how someone would, like, even if you were interested in the story, like, how someone would, like, turn the film, it's like, yeah.
I feel, I've had good and bad experiences kind of showing his films to other people. I feel like his style can be a little overwhelming for people that like a more structured approach to how films are made and how stories are told, which is fine, is totally normal. But I just love how all of his films are just so challenging and just so rich, and there's so much stuff going on.
Yeah, like, I mean, you could spend hours and hours and days and write like a thesis about, like, just one movie. Like, there's just, like, you could, like, I could spend, like, 2 weeks, like, studying, like, 5 minutes of The Host.
Yes. The Host in particular, I think, is, in terms of the combination of different genres, probably just the best example of his talent as a director and as a storyteller. There's so many different cues taken from so many different genres. It's kind of jarring for some people. I showed it to a couple of friends that were like, what the hell was going on with that film?
Yeah, I can see that.
But if you get it, if it speaks to you, then it's amazing. Really, really amazing.
Meow!
That was one of my cats.
Was it butter?
It was butter.
Yeah. He wants to be fed.
No, he agrees with me that Bong Joon-ho isn't.
Yes, exactly. you wouldn't be a film scholar without your cats loving all the same films that you do.
Exactly. I've trained them well. Yeah. So I guess, why did we decide to talk about these two films together?
Well, I mean, there's the structure part, which is the podcast has to deal with at least one film that's in theaters now.
Right.
Okja's not playing in Phoenix, by the way. I tried to see it in theaters, but not available. But it's on Netflix.
It is on Netflix, yes.
And I mean, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I think part of the reason we chose it is because you love this director.
Yes.
And I think that you really wanted to expose me to this director and just, like, see what I thought about it.
Yes, and that's totally true. I guess the thematic kind of link between the two of them that I was thinking of is the fact that they're monster movies, or creature movies. There's a central kind of creature in each film that's part of the narrative in a meaningful way. It's just literally a sea creature kind of monster thing in The Host, and Okja in Okja. And I thought it was interesting to kind of talk about his approach to this kind of like genre. And
yeah. And by also, the way, before you keep going, Okja is a super pig for anyone who was wondering.
Okja, yeah, we should probably at some point summarize the plot. It to me, Okja looks like a hippo more than a pig, but they call it a super pig. I don't know if it's like, no, it's not even something that's like lost in translation, because no, it's just literally some sort of cross between a pig and a hippo, but it doesn't really look like a pig. It's just a really cute...
Well, I mean, I think they also call it a pig because part of the narrative is that, like... Okay, do you want to do spoilers? I mean, I feel like it's more...
Let's meaningful. Do light spoilers.
Light spoilers. Okay, yeah. So part of the narrative of Okja is, like, that there's this genetic testing program being put on by this one company, and they're trying to sell it as this amazing thing that... Sorry, the creation of the super pigs is going to... like and world hunger and change the way that people think about food, but really it's just a genetic experimentation and kind of animal exploitation program, and they're doing really horrible things. So
the what's the name of the organization? I don't remember, but
Mirando Corporation.
Mirando, yeah. So the Mirando Corporation is behind the engineering, like the breeding of this. The super pig. And yeah, so it seems as though there's like humanitarian concerns behind it, that they want to solve like the issues of like world hunger by creating like I guess these kind of cheaper alternatives of like mass produced or mass bred
meat,
pig meat. But there's really a lot more behind it. It's a lot shadier, as we learn later on in the film. And I think that's part of why I really liked the setup of the story, because it's framing this in ways that are kind of complex and compelling, because you're forced to ask, as much as you like Okja, you're forced to ask yourself, wouldn't an enterprise of this sort really be amazing and important, even with all?
Oh, that's interesting. See, I never even thought that. I think it's interesting that you even thought about that, because like the horrors that you see at the end about the actual process, I mean, like that never even crossed my mind.
It was hard to watch, but when they're presenting the program at the beginning of the film. And I mean, you know that these animals are bred to then be slaughtered, right? I guess you're put in this position where, knowing Okja, you're really rooting for her, and she's adorable and she's this great, fantastic animal. But then at the same time, you wonder, this program is actually an amazing program, and how do I really feel about it? Because,
I'm going to say you, let's not use you as a general term, because I did not, that never crossed my mind
once. Yeah, no, it's a you in terms of people watching the film. Yeah, in terms.
I know, I'm just saying that I didn't think that once, so I'm not sure that's as universal as you think.
No. Yeah, I should say I was wondering what could really come of a humanitarian effort to really make cheap food alternatives available to countries in need. It would be something worth thinking about.
Okay, so Okja, do we want to go into that more?
Should we kind of summarize what happens in the film? Kind of.
Yeah, I'll do that. So basically, like Francesco was saying, so the Mirando Corporation is this corporation that's essentially this old sort of cutthroat corporation that is rebranding, I guess, as a more modern company and trying to rehabilitate their image. And at the beginning, you think that they're, you know, actually going for some sort of humanitarian angle, though you learn at towards the end of the, or I mean, in the middle of the film, that they don't really care about that. It's just about their stock price and stuff like that. But anyway, so the film basically opens with Tilda Swinton's character, who's the CEO of Miranda Corporation, presenting to a bunch of people in this old Miranda factory in New York and announcing this super pig program and a contest. Essentially, they drop, I think it's 16 super pigs across the world,
something like that.
Yeah. And then basically let them grow up for 12 years or 13 or whatever it is. And then at the end, they're going to see who has the best super pig, basically. And so end that scene, and then we cut to it's in Korea, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we cut to Korea, basically in this lush forest where Okja and Mija, Okja being the pig and Mija being this young girl that is helping raise her and is extremely attached to Okja, are sort of messing around the forest. You find out that Mija lives with her grandfather, and essentially there's sort of a play between him and her because he knows the truth that Okja is going to be, you know, slaughtered, and she does not. You know, she's a young girl, and she just loves Okja. So essentially Okja is taken away from them by the corporation, you know, for this purpose, alleged purpose of, you know, bringing her to New York because she won the best super big competition. And basically the driving point of the story is that Mija is desperate to get her back. And basically that plays out through their home in the forest, through Seoul, and through New York. So that's about it without any spoilers.
Yeah. And one of the most interesting things about the film, as I was reading about the film, is how different people are describing it differently. As some are calling it a comedy, some are calling it a drama, some are calling it an action film, some are calling it some sort of like sci-fi fantasy, and it's kind of all of these things, but also none of them. And that's one of, I guess, the markers of Bong Joon-ho as a director, his interest in kind of combining different genres in the same story, in the same film, and I guess playing with the audience's perception of how the story is being framed, which I thought was really, really successful here.
Well, I think that, see, I don't see it as much of blending genres, though, you know, obviously that is the point to a certain extent. I think of it as telling a story as you want to tell a story, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, basically saying that I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not going to say, like, living within a genre is lazy, but I'm not going to just do what this genre, this type of movie tells me to.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can see the same thing in how he shoots, his sound design, his character's acting. Like, it's across the board. It's basically a philosophy of, I'm going to make the film that I want to make.
Yes.
And I don't really care if it doesn't fit within any box.
Exactly.
And for a person like me and a person like you, I think that's what makes it great, is that, yeah. It literally, like, his work, it stands on its own.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really different from anything I've seen. I mean, you've seen a lot more films than I have, but I've seen a lot of films. I've seen probably more films than 95% of people, I would think. So, yeah, it was stunning to watch, and especially the host for me, Okja. It was interesting. I got way more into the story of Okja. Like, mm-hmm. I was way more attached to it than the host, but visually and in a lot of other ways, the host just blew me away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I totally agree. And I agree that one of the things that attracts me the most to him is how he just doesn't care about kind of keeping up with like generic conventions, in terms of, I'm making, I don't know, I'm thinking of Memories of Murder. I'm making like this serial killer murder mystery. But I don't care that I'm expected to do it this way. I don't care that I'm making a monster movie and I'm supposed to do it this way and this way and this way. He just has a vision that's really, I guess, unique and really out of the box. And he's really, I think, ballsy in terms of being able to play with tone, but still being confident in his message coming across as powerfully as he wants it to.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what some of the messages in each film are? I actually, that's the one thing that I took some notes on from Okja, and then
you're a lot more prepared than I am for this.
Oh, no, it's cool. Okay, so I want to talk about it. In terms of, I guess I'll do kind of both, like what they have in common, and then like what's different. So one thing that I really liked is in both films is an irreverence for authority, mm-hmm. and basically saying that authority, besides being in power, like authority has no authority over anyone, mm-hmm. because they're like, they don't really give a shit about anything, and they're just like a mess. Like in both films, like you see, like in The Host, you see this, sorry, in both films you see basically an inability of anyone that's in the government or in business or in medicine or whatever to mm-hmm. basically where they're supposed to be controlling the situation and they just can't because they're
right.
sort of robotic and bureaucratic. I love the scene in The Host where I'll set it up a little bit, but the scene in The Host towards the end where the main character is basically, they've been doing all these tests on him, and he's trying to get out and save his daughter from the monster. And they do this extraction of blood, and then he uses a syringe because everyone's afraid of getting this virus that allegedly he's supposed to have. Mm-hmm. And basically threatens, like, there's, like, 100 people, like, between him and, like, a car to get out of there. And he like, basically, like, holds them all hostage with this syringe. And the irony of it all is that there's no virus. But these people are basically following orders without questioning them at all. And
right.
it's just really – the part where he finally comes out of the trailer that he's in, and then there's the, like, the American general guy, like, grilling sausages on the barbecue. And then he's like, you're fucking eating? And he turns over the barbecue.
That's
that. And then in Okja I think the one that's most emblematic of the scene that's most emblematic of that is where the animal rights activists, they basically kidnap Okja and Mija from the hands of the corporation. This is in Seoul. And there's this scene where basically there's a Korean company man from Mirando that has been sort of friendly with Mija and Okja, but it turns out basically that he actually doesn't give a shit about them. He just wants to keep his job. And there's this, he's basically trying to keep the animal rights activists and Mija and Okja from escaping. And he gets behind the truck and the door is open and Okja just starts shitting on him, like literally, just starts like pushing out poop, like right on him, and he falls. And you know what's funny is there's in both films, like people slip and fall like a lot. It's kind of funny. Yeah. Yes.
This idea of undermining authority is kind of like something he does in all of his films. And again, something that he's able to do regardless of the genre that he's playing with, because he does it a lot in Memories of Murder too, where really it's not just about showing how ineffective like the police are in running the investigation, but also how in the end, in a story where we're looking for a murderer who ends up getting punished, differently punished, is the cops. And so he does a lot of that, and I think that's part of like what we were saying in terms of him not really caring about conventions and I guess more stereotypical modes of storytelling.
Do you think it's easier for him because of working in Korea? Does that have anything to do with it, do you think?
I guess it does in terms of, I think, his inspiration, especially I'm thinking, for example, of the scene at the police station in The Host, where I don't remember exactly what happening, but the family of the girl that went missing, they all kind of gather there and they all start crying. And it seems as though at some point they start trying to like one up each other in terms of who's crying the hardest.
Yeah, I love that scene. I didn't really get it, but yeah, it
was really funny. Straight out of like those Korean soap operas that are so popular there, where like the drama is so over the top that it ends up being almost ridiculous. Right.
Yeah.
Also the part at the end where they're trying to kill the monster, and I think there's like a gag where the ant is aiming with her bow and arrow, and that she ends up missing at like this moment where we want like this release of like the monster
getting killed. But I thought you were gonna say a different one. There's the moment where the uncle has the last Molotov cocktail.
That's what I mean.
He goes to it's slow-mos and close-up shot of him focusing, and then he just drops it.
There's like repeated moments at the end where we're expecting one of the characters to like just deliver the final blow, and it's continuously like undermined and kind of played for laugh. At a point in time, we're like on the edge of our seat, just kind of like waiting to see what happens.
Like everything is at stake, basically.
Yes. And he does a lot of that. He does a lot of kind of like there's this kind of like approach to comedy that is very physical. Something that, I don't know, it reminds me a lot of also like, I don't know, American sitcoms from like the 50s, for example, like, I don't know, I Love Lucy,
Dick,
stuff like
Dick that. Dick Van Dyke, yeah.
Yeah. And he you wouldn't think to like have that happen at a point in time where there's like the final confrontation between a monster and the guy trying to kill it, and somehow he does it and it works. It's just it's just really, really weird and funny, and it kind of resets your expectations in terms of what the hell is gonna happen here.
Well, he also, but okay, so I kind of now agree with you that he is intentionally, it's not just about making a great film on your own terms, it also is about parodying genres a little bit.
Oh yeah, totally. Totally.
Like just the shot with the Molotov cocktail, it's literally a complete remake of like say like Bruce Willis and Die Hard has to like, by the way, I haven't seen Die Hard, which is horrible, but let's say Bruce Willis in Die Hard has to like, or like Harrison Ford in Clear and Present Danger is like taking the shot to save the president. Like it's that exact shot where it's slow-mo and you can see all the emotion in lines on his face. And he just drops the ball. Completely.
It's kind of like this unmaking of the action hero where he reminds you that the protagonist that you're really invested in is just kind of an idiot. And you're rooting for him and you really want him to succeed. And like all these horrible things happen to him. But at the end of the day, he is completely mediocre in every possible way. There's nothing superhuman or just admirable about him. He's just, an idiot. And I think that really, really works in terms of like playing with our expectations of, what we want from a leading character in a film or an action movie or something like that. It just works because it's different. It's surprising.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about deconstruction then. Like, why do you think that he intentionally deconstructs a genre? What is the point that he's making with that?
I think in a way it's, him wanting to kind of like reframe it as a parody of scenes and stories that we've just watched so many times at the movies, that we're so used to kind of expecting exactly this and this and this in this order. And he wants to kind of show how ridiculous it becomes, because it becomes so formulaic after a while. And also, I think because, and this is especially true of his Korean productions, he is so dialed in like Korean kind of pop culture, where there's all these different cues that don't really make sense to people that don't know how to pick them up. But I think for Korean audiences, they know exactly what he's doing, what his aim is in terms of making fun of Korean soap operas, or kind of undoing this figure of the kind of like central male character. Because part of the one of the main themes of the Korean wave in terms of like films that started coming out of Korea in like the 90s and onwards was really reclaiming a strong male figure.
Okay.
Yeah. And then he arrives, and his protagonist is literally I'm trying not to say idiot again, but like, yeah, the most basic, clueless person you could think of.
Okay, speaking of being repetitive, the guy that I met when I was seeing The Beguiled alone, who mm-hmm. this guy Ryan, who was also seeing The Beguiled alone, he literally, we went and saw Baby Driver on Friday, and after the movie, we sat outside in the fucking 110 degree heat at 10:30 p.m. Thanks, Phoenix. and he was like, "Yeah, I listened to the second episode of the podcast. You guys said problematic a lot." And I was like, "Yeah, that was pretty problematic."
Well, it's Sofia Coppola's fault.
Yeah. Also, I was a mess last week. So, and we just kind of went for something different that especially was not conducive to me being in a bad mood. Just like the structure of it. Like, this feels so much better the way we're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, we're testing different ways to go about this, and this is more like a conversation. Yeah.
But it's a lot less repetitive.
Yeah.
I did feel like last time was pretty repetitive. Like, we probably could have caught off like 15 minutes of that at least.
Yeah. Well, you know, well, we're going to get it right eventually.
Yeah. Anyway, so you were talking about just kind of deconstructing the central male figure that came out of the Korean New Wave.
Yeah, so like he does it really, really well in all of his. Well, I don't want to say all of his films, but in for sure in The Host, and in Memories of Murder too, where really the two main characters are in different ways both completely unequipped to deal with the complexity of the investigation. And you would think that in the end, the way that they're presented, that they're able to combine their strengths, but they don't. They don't. And it, I mean, there's really, in terms of like interplay of different genres, Memories of Murder doesn't really do that a lot. But these ideas are still present in different ways in terms of like kind of requalifying the leading central male figure in kind of Korean like new wave narratives. He does that really, really well.
So why did you want to do The Host instead of Memories of Murder as the secondary kind of past film?
Because I feel like I should probably at this point disclose that Memories of Murder is my favorite film.
Yes.
And I think that there's a case to be made.
30 minutes in the, 30 yes. minutes into it, we learned the truth.
that it's really one of the greatest films of all time. So I, if we ever end up doing a podcast on Memories of Murder, I just want it to be about Memories of Murder. That's it. Yeah. So I can just like talk about it for 4 hours. But I thought I didn't really think about like making connections to Memories of Murder, because I thought like in terms of the story and in terms of the way that the story is told, that there were more points of contact with Okja and the host. Also because it's really the two films where he, I guess, presents some sort of like ecological kind of argument.
It's funny actually that the thing that I chose first was the authority having no authority theme that kind of overlays both films, because I mean, yeah, the whole ecological thing is maybe more salient, I think, than even that. I think that the disrespecting authority thing just spoke to me, because I'm all about that.
but it's so awesome that you picked up on that, because then it is really something that he is really interested in all of his films. All I haven't seen his very first film. I own it, but I've never got around it. But in all of his other films, it's something that in to some degree he always does. Yeah.
And I like that parallel with disrespect of genre and form, with sort of, because the genre is the authority, right, in this analogy.
You know, totally. The genre is dictating. That's such a good like transition. It's exactly that, the same thing. The genre is dictating how you're supposed to tell a certain story, what parameters you're supposed to use, it's kind of like the framework that you're given, that you're supposed to kind of operate within. And he's like, no thanks.
Yeah And I love that. One thing I question, though, is like who watches and enjoys his films? Like, you know, there's people like you and I who really like to analyze and think about film, but like, I don't know. I think I'm saying this because like genre. So and why both films spoke to me so much is that I really hate sort of genre repetitiveness. It's like boring, and I think it's dumb. And that's part of the reason that I didn't like Wonder Woman. I just like. And a lot of other people liked it. I just feel like, I literally feel like whenever I see a film that I like in theaters, everyone else in the theater is like, what the fuck? And then when I'm in a movie that everyone else likes, I'm like, this is garbage. But the point is like,
yeah.
The point is like, I don't know. It just kind of depresses me that, like, what I'm trying to get at is, how much does this type of film matter if normal people aren't going to enjoy it?
Normal people in terms of like the average moviegoer?
The average moviegoer.
I don't know that that's even the intended market for.
No, I understand. I'm not talking about market. I'm just talking about like, okay, so in an ideal world, I would hope that making these kinds of films has an effect on the, or at least as an artist, has an effect on future films that would be made by other directors, other casts, producers, whatever, right?
Right.
Because you're basically saying the art form has been trapped in a box, whether that's a pink box for romantic comedies, whether it's a red box for shoot 'em ups, whether it's, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're saying we need to be done with that. But my question is like, can you make this kind of movie and have it be effective towards the type of art that comes out in the future? But for what I'm saying is, can you have it affect the movie going experience or the industry as a whole? Because I would think to some extent that would be the point of it.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about, I feel like we're approaching this from like the point of view of like American like moviegoers and like U.S. like filmmaking industry, whereas he is wildly popular in South Korea. He's one of the
most... Yeah, I didn't think about that angle. I mean,
he's one of
that's a classic thing for an American to do.
No, but he's one of the most.
Where's South Korea?
What's South Korea?
South what?
he's one of the most famous directors in South Korea, and The Host was, I think he's in. It's in the top 10 of like the most watched movies of all time in South Korea. They do it a little differently. They don't go by box office. They go by admissions in South Korea to
like number of people that saw the film.
Number of tickets sold.
Yeah,
that's what they do. Yeah, and The Host especially is one of the most popular films of all time in South Korea. So I feel like in terms of, I guess, reaching out to different audiences, he's done that really, really well in his own country.
Yeah.
In the US, I don't know. It feels like foreign films here always have to work twice as hard to get like half the spectatorship of other, like,
for sure,
domestic films. He was also kind of very unlucky in terms of distribution for Snowpiercer because the Weinsteins tried to like basically boycott the film. At some point it looked like it wasn't even going to come out. So I feel like, though, in terms of like audiences that attend like festivals and audiences are a little more kind of dialed in, that he's making a mark, and now people are kind of learning about who he is and what he does. And in a way, it's great. And I think it's great that the last two films that he's made have this sort of like international kind of aura to them. There's like actors of like different nationalities, and they're like
different languages.
Yeah, different languages and like international
different kind of, scenes.
Yeah, like setting and everything, and also the money is coming from different countries. But I think really he's at his best when he's talking about Korean stories with a Korean cast. That's where he's really, really skilled at like playing with like the cultural idiosyncrasies of South Korea, and that's what makes Memories of Murder, Mother, and all of his other films so good, that they're so dialed in like the cultural circumstances of the country.
Yeah, sorry, I just had a moment where I was like, literally like halfway into like a lot of the podcast so far, I've just been like, what if his mic isn't recording? Like, what if this is all for nothing?
Oh, they're just going to listen to you talk to yourself and like an imaginary friend.
Yeah. Which, by the way, the first time that I did it, I didn't know how the recording service works. So I started listening to, basically what it does is it separates into two tracks, each person that's on.
That's what I did.
Yeah. And we were listening to ourselves and we're like, where's Cheeky?
I hit play on the track and I'm like, well, that's just me talking to myself and my imaginary friend Mitch. That guys, he totally exists. He is so dreamy. Yeah,
he's a wonderful co-host. He just lets me like, he lets me talk and get my message out there.
He exists in my head. Yeah. We're real people.
Yeah.
I forgot what I was saying. Doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, I think you were, I was hoping you were close to an end of a thought at least, because I just wanted to butt in a little bit.
Yeah, no, yeah, I was really, it was more of like a general reflection. Now I'm happy that he made Snowpiercer and that he made Okja, but then I hope his next film is kind of like a South Korean project.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just want to apologize for being so ignorant of other cultures, you know. I
why are you ignorant?
I'm just kidding. Yeah. I have a very America first worldview, so I anyway. No, I just felt a little bit badly because usually I'm smart enough to think about the fact that, you know, not all films are made for US audiences, but
no, but I mean,
it was also, I think the other thing is I know literally nothing about South Korea besides like K-pop and
right.
kimchi. I like know nothing about South Korean culture. So
right. I think it was an interesting point to raise. Like, I guess even like regardless of his circumstances, like Bong Joon-ho, it's just in terms of like what makes a film relevant and what makes a film a game changer. It's something we can talk about some other time, but it's, I think,
well, do you want to talk about like what this film means in the context of like being an American moviegoer? Like, I mean, that's our audience, probably.
It's, I think for Okja especially, it's really kind of, I don't want to say an indictment, but a meditation on consumerism, probably.
Yeah, I actually meant more in terms of like effects on the art form. I don't know. Honestly, I'm just kind of hoping, like, I'm hoping and wishing that that like Hollywood will watch it someday, watch his films and be like, oh yeah, we should not be so lazy.
Yeah, I feel like if anything, I don't want people to start copying him because they're not going to be successful. I mainly want people to be inspired by him.
Yeah. No, yeah. I it would be really, it would be weird to copy him exactly, but you want to you want to steal from him at the same time the kind of stuff that he's doing. Like, you know, we have had some ideas for a couple of screenplays, and you know, I was just like, after watching The Host, I was like, okay, well, you know, the visual aspect is really, really important, and we're not going to be lazy on that.
But I mean, it's a really important kind of issue to raise because, and I mean, maybe he is having some sort of like effect on how like younger filmmakers are now approaching their, I guess, their own inspiration. Because do you remember, I think I sent you a link to that video about how the director of Moonlight, God, I can't remember his name.
Barry Jenkins,
thank you. Was so inspired by Wong Kar-wai in terms of like structuring a lot of like the scenes in Moonlight. And
I don't think I read it.
no, it was a video. It was basically like juxtaposing like scenes from Wong Kar-wai films and scenes from Moonlight.
Well, I definitely didn't read it because it was a video, and I definitely didn't watch it. I definitely didn't watch it either. So,
but I mean, who would?
Guess I don't love you as much as you thought.
I'm pretty sure you watched it. You just don't remember because I think we talked about it a little bit, but. Who would have thought that Barry Jenkins would like be inspired, or really like anybody would?
Well, yeah, not Barry Jenkins specifically. Yeah.
Yeah. Be inspired by Wong Kar-wai to a degree that his language just informs your own language as a filmmaker to that degree. And I mean, Barry Jenkins is an amazing director with a very, very distinct voice, but I think it was still kind of amazing for me to watch how he kind of reinterpreted some of those scenes and some of those images. It was amazing. So who knows? Maybe someone else is being inspired by Bong Joon-ho.
I hope so. And if you haven't watched Moonlight, go watch it. It's deserve the Oscar 100%. It's so good.
Yes.
And it transcends getting an Oscar. It's just such an important film.
Yes.
And then do us a quick explainer of who Wong Kar-wai is, because I don't even really know.
Wong Kar-wai is I think one of the most famous, probably the most famous directors to come out of Hong Kong, and He has made a host of different films. 2046. No pun intended. In the Mood for Love. And In the Mood for Love, I think, in particular, was kind of a watershed moment in terms of filmmaking in the last two decades, I would say. If you haven't seen it, definitely. No, I mean, not just you, in terms of like people listening, like, or we have audiences by the fives and tens, but I mean, if yes. you haven't seen
Hi, it, everyone.
really do make a point to get around it. It's this sort of like approach to film that is all about mood and atmosphere and very little dialogue. The use of colors and camera blocking. It is just really, really brilliant.
Is camera blocking different from like actor blocking?
Well, actor blocking happens in camera blocking.
So is it the placement of the camera in the scene?
It's literally what is inside of the shot and what's outside of the shot, including the actors in that case. Yeah.
Cool.
It is a story.
Thanks, Professor.
You're welcome. It is. Doctor. It is. Doppel-doctor. It is a very relatable story about two people who are falling in love, but then it's told in this just amazing way. So yes. Very, very highly recommend it. And also, he did Chungking Express, which is really, really hard to get around. I think the Criterion.
Oh,
is
out that's of print. The one that I've heard of. Yeah,
yeah. The Criterion is out of print, so if you want to like blow like a month's rent on eBay to get a copy of that, I think it's still probably worth it. But yeah,
I'm gonna blow a month's worth of pop-ups and stream it online.
Yay. I'm trying to find ways to get around it, and it's not easy, but it's also a very good example of the kind of like cinema that he's interested in. We went like way off tangent
with this. Oh no, it's cool. I think we should wrap up pretty soon.
Yeah.
What'd you say the name of the film was? Chungking Express?
Chungking Express.
Chungking Express. Okay.
Chungking Express. Yes.
Cool. So we're gonna start releasing a daily podcast that's 5 minutes, and it's gonna be called Chungking Express.
It is my train that I own and operate. Yeah. It's really, really great. I guess should we like wrap up with like some like I guess like what did you like the most about the two films? Like one aspect that you like the most.
Okay, so I liked the one actor. He was really cute. I'm trying to remember his name.
There are a lot of cute actors.
And like the monster was just, it was okay. Like it was just weird.
It didn't look like a pig.
What I like the most, I feel like I've already covered that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make me repeat myself.
Okay. I will say that what I liked the most about, the host was the use of, depth of focus.
What I liked the most about the host.
Oh my God. I'm rhyming and I don't even realize it. What was I saying? The depth of the shots in terms of like setting up shots that don't necessarily where the action doesn't necessarily happen with the camera moving like left to right or right to left, but it's I guess layers of depth in the same shot.
And I think the best example of that is like where any scene where like multiple people are like peeking through like an opening in a wall or like a doorway or something. There's at least two scenes in the film that are like that. And it's just like, you have one person in the foreground on the left, you have the another person in the sort of the middle section on the right, and then far behind them out of focus is like one other person or something.
My favorite example in The Host is the scene at the beginning where the daughter gets abducted and she is running towards the dead, and then the monster appears behind her, and it's done so well. So
yeah. You know what also was amazing was this, like, in that same scene where, like, all the people, like, go into this, like, storage unit and lock it, and you know what I'm talking about? And then, like, you're expecting because of the, oh, I'm sorry, they lock it, and then they lock this one girl out, and because of, like, the horror tropes, you expect, you're like, oh, that girl's screwed, that girl's gonna get eaten.
Yes.
And then what happens is actually all the people inside the locked, like, car get eaten. It's amazing. I loved it.
Yeah, that's the opening sequences in The Host are phenomenal, phenomenal, so entertaining. I guess what I like the most about Okja is how how Okja is shot. The fact that and I think I wrote about this in the review where she is shot I guess more in terms of like long shots where she's whole in South Korea. And then there's a lot more close-ups on different like body parts. She's kind of like fractured in all the scenes that take place in the US, which I think
is
indicative of, first of all, how she feels in South Korea, as opposed to how she feels in the US, but also in terms of like what her, I guess what her destiny is in either country where she gets to live her life as a whole creature in South Korea, whereas in the U.S. she's gonna get cut up and butchered and sold out in different like pieces. And I think it was done really, really well.
My favorite part about Okja, the actual super pig, was the eyes. Basically, how you know, there's this point made in the film that, you know, through it's not explicitly said, but through a bunch of scenes that like animals are like humans in a lot of ways.
Yes.
So let's not basically treat them as we are crappily treating animals at the moment. But basically, like, there's all these close-ups in both locations of Okja's eyes, and they're like brown and extremely human looking. Like they have all the complex structures of like a human, you know, human eye and iris. They're these like deep, beautiful brown. And then at one point, something terrible happens to Okja, and her eyes turn to red.
Yeah,
yeah. And then eventually, it goes back to brown. But yeah, that was one of my favorite things about the film, were her eyes. They did such a good job on that.
Yeah, I feel like something that I really struck me was really like, I guess how we as humans interact with animals and how different but also how similar we are, and how that should give us pause in terms of first of all the way that we relate to animals, but also the way that we relate to each other.
The way that we relate to our food too, to a certain extent. I think I'm good.
Yeah.
Do you want to wrap it up?
Yeah.
Let's do a little plug. So,
Yay.
Our blog, which eventually will become our blog. I haven't posted anything yet.
It is still our blog.
Yes.
You made it happen. So,
is thevisualtext.com. That's our site. And then you'll see some links for blog, about, and podcast.
We have a working podcast. Email now. It's thevisualtext@gmail.com. So you can You can send us your ideas. You can send us nudes, whatever you want to send us. We'll take it.
Yes. And also if you want to be a guest on the podcast, cause we're going to incorporate that soon. I think maybe one more episode and then we start having guests. Possibly.
Yeah, that'd be really, really great. We need to start lining up guests and also like contributors for the actual website, people that want
for to sure.
For us.
So I think that's it. We have a Facebook page. We have a Twitter page. Do we have a Twitter page yet?
We do, the visual text on Twitter, which is going to be the page, I think, for the blog, but also for the podcast. Because
I think that's better. We don't need separate ones.
Yeah, we're going to rename the podcast probably at some point.
The visual text.
To the visual text. So, yeah, everything will run on that Twitter page concurrently.
Yep. The podcast, regardless of how you're listening, it's on iTunes and Google Play. If you could give us a rating, that'd be awesome.
Yay.
Eventually, we hope to get advanced screenings if we blow up, so that we can, I don't know. That's just kind of a goal of ours. That'd be really awesome, of movies that are coming into theaters.
Eventually, I plan on having Glenn Close on the podcast.
I'm going to take this and run for president.
Yes, but I'll take Meryl Streep, too, if she's listening.
Yes. Also, Meryl Streep, you're too good for all the movies that you're in, if you're listening.
Meryl Streep, make better movies, you're lazy.
Yeah.
I love you, but you're lazy.
Yes.
Okay.
Steak! Where's my steak?
No! All right.
That's it, people. I'm Mitchell Cravens, that's Francesco Pascuzzi, and we're out.
Bye!
Love ya.